First of all, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation and for the opportunity to speak. So what I want to address in this talk is the computation of the anomalous dimensions in ABJM and ABJ at four loops here. And this is work in progress with my collaborators Joe Minahan and Olof Olsen-Sachs, who is here. So let me first remind you that the story of this was that last year at the Integrability Conference, Joe brought up the idea to compute four-loop anomalous dimensions, and basically we have then started in October of last year this project, and it turned out to be always more and more complicated. Until now, we have nearly arrived at the final result. There are still some last checks to be done, but hopefully within this month, the paper will appear. So let me first give the outline of the talk. So I will start with introduction of motivation, where I can be rather brief, because the speakers of this morning and also Sung Jung has already introduced a lot of this. I will then focus on the SU2 times SU2 subsector. I will show how you extract H of lambda from the answer for the dilatation operator. Then I will, as a warm-up, repeat a little bit the two-loop calculation so that you get used to the formalism a little bit. Then I will come to the four-loop calculation, in particular then also comment on ABJ versus ABJM theory and there on the symmetries. And then at the end, I want to argue a little bit why it took us so long to get the computation done. So there are some difficulties in three dimensions and some difficulties because of the Feynman rules, which had to be resolved, and this is why the project became so long. So as a motivation, the ADS4 times CFT3 correspondence, or ABJM correspondence, states that you have type 2A string theory on ADS4 times CP3 background, and it should be dual to three-dimensional N equals 6 Trans-Simons theory. So you can now play the same game as in ordinary ADS5 times CFT4 correspondence. You can compare string energies to the anomalous dimensions of composite operators in the two regimes where the strings are valid for, I mean, the string approximation for large lambda, whereas perturbation theory in the gauge side is valid for small lambda. And underlying to all this is there seems to be, again, integrable systems here, and in particular, a dispersion relation which relates the energy of a magnon in terms of its momentum, and the same is true here on the for the underlying composite operators, with one important difference with respect to n equal 4 superangmils, namely that the function here, h of lambda squares, might be a non-trivial function in terms of the coupling. So the question is, what is this h of lambda? And to remind you, the standard ADS CFT correspondence is just basically the coupling constant itself. And here, it is found from the strong coupling limit that it should behave at strong coupling as lambda half, whereas at weak coupling it starts with lambda square. So this seems to suggest that this function is non-trivial, and we should start to find out what it is. And doing that, we focus on this branch here. So we compute anomalous dimensions for composite operators to four loops, and this should give us information on the next constant which comes in here in the weak coupling expansion. No, I mean, there's no good argument to say that it's trivial in ADS5. Just from perturbation theory, one sees that, I mean, I will come to scheme dependence and things like this a little bit later, but, I mean, the weak coupling limit fixes this for you. The question is what happens with strong coupling, so I don't know. I mean, so let me very briefly remind you of the SU2 times SU2 subsector. So the fields, we have two kinds of fields here, of scalar fields YA and YA dagger, which transform as bifundamentals and anti-bifundamentals in the product gauge group here. And the transgression to the ABJ theory means now that we change the rank of one of the gauge groups and make it different from N. So we have M and N as the ranks. So then we can build up gauge invariant operators by summing up indices here, up and down indices, so the two conjugate representations. And that means we get an alternating ring of alternating contractions of the two gauge groups. Now let me come to the flavor structure. So we have four and four bar fundamental and anti-fundamental representations of SU4 as flavor indices, which corresponds to this capital indices A and this green A here. So we have four states sitting at each side here, and you can take flavor traces meaning that you can sum up here in this direction the fields in the different, on the different spin chain sites. So the two, there is a subgroup of that. That means that we have the four fields here transform as SU2 under, times SU2 under the under subgroup SU2 times SU2. And in that case, there are still flavor traces, but what we now do, we project out, so we look at the excitations only of here the first and here of the second group of fields, meaning that the trace building is not possible, so this is a traceless subsector. So meaning that this is the sector, we, the easiest thing we can think about, so we throw away all trace terms which can appear and just look to SU2 times SU2 excitations. Yeah, and then what we arrive at is we have two possibilities for state at each site, meaning that we are basically at two, arrived at two interlaced Heisenberg chains in that limit. So the SU2 times SU2 subsector, there have been constructed beta equations by Mina and Zaremba, Buck and Ray, and the full all-order form by Gromov and Vieira. And in the SU2 times SU2 subsector, they look like this. They are two copies of the Heisenberg chain, but they are coupled by the momentum conservation condition and also by the dressing phase factor here. So here you see the standard, let's say, scattering matrix, the product of scattering matrix on the right-hand side of the beta equations, and then there's the coupling factor which couples even at odd sites and which comes from the dressing phase. And here's the momentum condition. So the dispersion relation is now a sum of two independent dispersion relations for the even and odd and even sign magnons, but they have the same form here and the same function h of lambda appearing here. And I will also comment on that. So very briefly, let me look to some of the states which appear in this SU2 times SU2 subsector. So the ground state is clearly one where we have no excitation, so we take, we choose one field for each of the even and odd lattice sites, and let's say associated with spin up, and then we can have excitations, that means, for example, single magnons here, meaning that we flip one spin on even sites down or one spin on odd sites down, and the momentum conservation condition tells us that these things have energy zero. Then, in addition, we can have two magnon states, and for example, excite two magnons at different sites here, so the energy is just the double of a single magnon dispersion relation, and the two momenta are opposite to fulfill the momentum condition, and then this will be a kind of state here where two excitations are in, so we have two downspins in a chain of upspins. So how can we extract h of lambda now if we can compute the four-loop dilatation operator? So for this, let's look at a momentum eigenstate of a single magnum, so we mean we just take an open word, no trace condition or something, of just a single impurity sitting somewhere, and look about which kind of phase shifts appear. And then it turns out that if we neglect the effects from the boundaries coming when we act with the dilatation operator here or here, so we just take the answer from acting on the product of middle states here, then we find that the answer for this dilatation operator on such a state is rearranged in terms of cosine of the momentum, and we have here maximum range interactions and next to maximum range interactions at four loops, and then we have constant pieces which do not touch the state at all. So, and then this can be compared to the lambda to the four coefficient of the energy of the dispersion relation by what we do is we expand h of lambda square in terms of the leading and the four loop part, expand the square root formula, and reshuffle everything in terms of cosine of the momentum. And then we see that we have a direct correspondence between the coefficients here. And from this coefficient, from the one which is depends just on cosine p and not on cosine 2p, so it's not maximal shuffling, from this one we can extract h4. And this is precisely one of the reasons why the calculation is complicated, because we really need all Feynman diagrams which lead to next to maximal shuffling. So the maximum shuffling terms are not sufficient. Then, by the comparison, we see here that the range-free interactions determine our coefficient H4 in terms of the answer here from the dilatation operator. And we have also checked which is the right five interactions should give a minus two here in front, which is exactly the check of at five loops that Sujong was talking about before. So let me comment on the scheme dependence of H of lambda And because I was explicitly asked in front of this conference, what I should say here is that from the gauge theory side, at least from the field perturbative calculation, everything seems to be quite rigid and clear as far as we understand it, because what we can do is, so first of all, we extract the dilatation operator by taking the derivative with respect to a dimensional quantity which comes in by regularization. So of the quantity which renormalizes, regularizes the divergences in our operator. So the operator, the renormalized operator, is given by a piece that subtracts the divergences, and then we have the bare operator here. So we have to take the derivative in this form, and in general, the coupling constant is, of course, a function of this mu here. So what now happens on the scheme change? So the coupling constant can become a function, non-trivial function of another coupling constant, of, let's say, in another scheme, we change the coupling constant as a power shear in terms of the original coupling constant. So we get, for example, here a term of cubic order. And then the most general change you can think about for this coefficient, for this matrix or operator Z here, is that you can have a rotation of the states, and you can also re-expand here this lambda prime of lambda in terms of lambda, which gives you, because this is matrix valued, this kind of product in a series. So this is the maximum general thing you can write down. And then, in a conformity theory, we now know that lambda is independent of mu, so meaning nothing else than the beta function is zero. So if we take the derivative as here, what survives at the end here from the, taking the derivative is just the first term, so there's just the rotation of the states possible. So and everything else should be more or less fixed. So that means that the eigenvalues of this dilatation operator should be scheme independent. And we should then, since H of lambda is fixed by matching the energies to the anomalous dimensions, then H of lambda should be scheme independent. So we expect that our H prime of lambda prime should be the same as an H of lambda if we change lambda prime as a function of lambda. So the next thing to discuss is how we regularize the theory. I mean, in time theory, they have the epsilon tensors coming in from the transimens term, for example. So that means that we have to deal, if we want to use some dimensional regularization of the integrals, what do we do with these epsilons? So, and the procedure here is to use dimensional reduction. So this has been proven to be consistent up to 3 loops in pure transimens and 2 loops in transimens but meta theories. And it works in our case here because the observation is that in all appearing 2 and 4 loop integrals which we have, so only 2 and 4 loop integrals are logarithmically divergent and therefore contribute to the anomalous dimensions or to the dilatation operator, the number of the epsilons plus the number of gamma traces with an odd number of gamma in a given Feynman diagram is always even. So what we can do, we can first expand products of even numbers of epsilon tensors in terms of scalar products, and then on the remaining purely scalar integrals with some numerators, we can reduce the dimension in the integral and use dimensional regularization. So let me now repeat the field theory calculation at 2 loops. So here at 2 loops, we have the following diagrams to consider. There is the maximum shuffling term or the sextet scalar interaction here. So this contributes with some trace terms here, and there is the identity, and there is an exchange term which exchanges flavor at sites 1 and 3. So what I do here, I fix the first site, let's say, to the even site, and then this bar here corresponds to my composite operator or some part of the composite operator which takes part in the interaction. So then we have other contributions coming from a fermion loop here that could sit here and here, and I have to include a factor of 1/2 here because later if I consider the odd sites, then I would do double counting if I shift this structure one to the right because this was already taken into account in terms of this diagram here. Then I have this kind of structure, so there seems to be a trace structure here, and then there are 2 gluons coming up and ending in this vertex here. I have simple gluon loops between neighboring sites here, and also I have self-energy contributions to individual lines. These are the diagrams to consider. And as you see, I have rearranged them in this way because you see that there is a mixing here between this diagram and these diagrams in that way that the trace terms here mix and here the identity mixes up. And the final result then is that you get something that is proportional to the permutation minus the identity plus these trace terms, and these trace terms cancel precisely out. So this is the final answer for the two-loop dilatation operator. And you might wonder about the coefficients here because there's lambda square over 4 and here's minus lambda square, but this comes because the definition, so these are really the poles in the integrals, so what I have to do is I have to multiply by minus 4 epsilon to arrive at the dilatation operator. So this is why I get this minus lambda square here. So then let's go to the SU2 times SU2 sector. In this sector, we don't bother ourselves with trace terms at all, so it means that a lot of things are already irrelevant for our calculation, and we are just left with these parts of the calculation. And you see the dilatation operator then becomes just permutation minus identity. And we don't even have to compute the identity later because we can fix it by demanding that the ground state is the ground state energy is zero. So we just have to compute later Feynman diagrams which contain permutations. So to do that, let's make a summary of what could be the permutation structures you find at four loops. So for this, I just borrow the notation for permutations in N equal 4 superhelmholtz theory you might be familiar with. So that means there is a curly bracket of certain integer values here, and m values signify that there's a product of m permutations, and in this case, that is in contrast to N equal 4, the permutations only permute flavor at either even or odd sides. There's no mixing here between odd and even sides. So the structures I can write down is, for example, for this kind of Feynman diagram, this kind of Flamer permutation is a 1,3. It means I go from this line, which sits at 5, I first compute the flavor at line 3 and 5 with each other. So the first index appears here. 5 is not shown. This is the second index of the permutation. And then I permute 1 and 3. So this is 1,3. So you act to the right with the structure. So this permutation comes first. Then I have the reflected diagram, which means just interchanging the two numbers. And here the two numbers, in contrast to N equal 4 superhelmholtz theory, don't commute because this is a hopping by two sides. And in N equal 4, we had a hopping by one side. So I couldn't interchange manipulate the structures. So the structures 1,3 is not identical to the structure 3,1 here, which in N equal 4 it was. Then I can shift the complete structure here by one side. So I will go from odd indices to even indices. That is the next possibility. I have this kind of interlaced interactions, which contain mixed even and odd sides. I have the trivial, or let's say the simple permutation at odd side and even side, and I have the identity, which I just denote by an empty bracket here. There's no permutation. So, and then the ansatz for the dilatation operator that you can write down is you have an interaction on the odd sides, an interaction on the even sides, and you have this mixing term, which somehow at the same time permutes odds and even sides. So, and as I said before, the coefficient of the identity can be fixed by fixing the action on the ground state, that the energy on the ground state, the energy of the ground state is zero. So this gives you that C0 is equal minus 2 C4 minus C5 minus C4 minus C3. And also integrability demands, this was also mentioned by Sujong, that this coefficient should be zero here. This is the next two maximal shuffling term. So we only have to calculate structures with permutations now. And this, these are the following structures. So let me go through it a little bit more careful. So we have in the theory the scalar 6 vertex, which is this green element here. Then we have four vertices of fermions, which, I mean, glue together fermions and scalars. And we have the same for scalars and gauge fields. And then we have cubic vertices with fermions and gauge fields, scalars and gauge fields and the pure gauge vertex. So now we write down all structures which contain at least the permutation and not only the identity. So the first thing to start is just using two scalar vertices here. Then we can have one scalar vertex and only four vertices. We can have one scalar vertex, a four vertex, and the rest three vertices, which are all of the same order. We can have a scalar vertex and only three vertices. Then we have some structures with only four vertices and some with only with four vertices but a pair of three vertices. And the reason that there are no structures, for example, of only three vertices and of just two four vertices and in that case four three vertices is that these contribute only to the identity. So this is the remaining structures which you can use the combinations of to compute the for loop answer for the permutations. So now let me comment on which range these interactions have. So the range 5 terms are, as Sujong said, is just a purely scalar. It's contained in this class here. The next two maximal shuffling, so the range 4 interaction, is in that class of fermion scalar interactions. And we have the range 3 part, which really contributes to the H function, so at the for loop correction. So that means that what we have to work through now is we have to compute all these black Feynman diagrams, which are depicted here in black. And to each class, there correspond more diagrams. So it's not said that there's a single diagram for it. So there are several diagrams coming in. So let me first comment so that you see how the calculation works. Let me repeat what Sujong said for the range 5 and range 4 and the complete scalar class here. So the range 5 diagram and its reflection has this permutation structure here, if you work it out carefully. Then we have a range 4 interaction, which is done with a scalar bubble and one with a fermion loop internally, which has this permutation structure. We have, for example, two scalar interactions of this form and of this form with a double bubble here in the middle, which contribute to the single permutations. So and this was presented by Sujong Ray that they worked it out in the paper of Blackman and Ray. So then let's come to the integrals. So what we have to compute is we have to compute the corresponding loop integrals here at four loops. So here, I remind you that this bold line here is a single point in X space. So this is where the composite operator, which is a local object, is sitting. So this is immediately obvious that this thing becomes that integral here because this line is shrinked to a point. So you arrive here, and you see that these and these structures have the same integral. So this integral is now tackled as follows. It's the easiest way to do this is in terms of so-called G functions, which is just a fraction of gamma functions. So you can work out what is a single bubble here in terms of gamma functions by just Fourier transforming to X space and Fourier transforming back. Then they get a factor for each bubble here. There is one bubble here and one bubble is here of G11 squared, where the 1-1 means that the weight of the propagator is just an ordinary scalar propagator, so it has 1 over p square of order 1. This is the 1 here. So then you fuse, by using the g function, you fuse such a bubble into a new line because the loop integral then depends on the external momentum, which is the momentum that is flying here, is flowing here through this line. So what you get is you contract the bubble, you get different weights for the propagators, which are now replace the bubble, and you can repeat the game with the next G function. So here, for example, there is a loop coming up here, which has a propagator weight 1/2 plus epsilon for one propagator, the other propagator has 1, so we get this factor. Then you repeat the same thing again. Oh, there's the factor missing. What's that? Okay. So you repeat the same thing again, and you see here there is popping up propagator weight 2 epsilon, which means that here there sits a subdivergence of two loops, which is very, very goodly visible here because this is just the two-loop divergent scalar integral you get. So this hints that you have to subtract subdivergences as well. So doing that then, doing the fusion of the last line, we get a fusion of this propagator weight with a unit propagator weight, and the integral is done. So we have finished that. And we can now expand in terms of epsilon, and subtract the subdivergence, and we arrive at this result. So what we get is we get the 2 over epsilon pole here, which I inserted here at these corresponding positions. Okay? Now you can do the same thing for the fermion integral, which is a little bit more complicated, but it works more or less in the same way. So you have the structure, if you work it out, is of this form. So the derivatives come from the gamma traces, where, or derivatives, as I said, the non-trivial numerator is just, if you work out the trace here over the gamma matrices. So there remains at the end a single contraction of 2 momenta. And here you can use the G functions to contract that bubble, and later to contract all this structure here with the last line, if, for example, your momentum flows from here to here. And then you arrive at this master integral, and this master integral you can tackle by partial integration, integration by parts method, or some other method that you like, and you get this result here. So now you add this result to here, and you find what was expected, namely that the next two leading shuffling terms exactly cancel. So this was one thing that was demanded by integrability. Next, we can have a look to this diagram here, which has 3 bubbles attached to each other, so it's of this form. So you get a G11 to the cube term here, and then the last factor is just, again, contracting this remaining propagator if this bubble is contracted with what remains here from that line. So you get this factor, and you see something that appears here, namely the integral is not rational in the R1 over epsilon pole, but it contains a zeta function. We've heard about this before. So this is the first argument that tells you that maybe the H function at 4 loops is not just a simple rational function, but contains zetas of 2, because it appears in such a simple integral here. And the reason, I mean, you can even check that you have, you have an idea of when zetas should appear. So, for example, if you, in this integral, you sit on that point and you get all lines that are connected to this point, then a single line remains. This means that the integral has a rational answer. If you sit here on that point and you cut the lines that are connected to this point, then a bubble remains. And this indicates that you have a summation left, and this summation, an infinite sum, gives you the zeta function. So you have a control about, if you see the integral, you can more or less say what type of answer you expect at the end. So let me now just present you what are the other diagrams of range 3 we have to compute to get the full loop answer. So there are box diagrams with fermion boxes here, and a scalar line running outside of the bubble. We have the same with inside of the bubble, and then there are 2 other possibilities for exchanging, this scalar line can run not to next to nearest, but to next to nearest vertices. So these are classes of this type here with just 4 vertices. We have classes here with 4 vertices and 3 vertices, which basically means that here we have inserted randomization of the a finite contribution to the field randomization for the fermions. Then we have couplings of gluons here in this form, and you might wonder why there is no coupling of the gluon to the outer lines. These integrals are finite, so we write down here only those ones which have a chance to be logarithmically divergent. Then you have the structures which contain a single 6 vertex. All the others we have taken into account, double 6 vertices we have taken into account before, which could have randomization of the scalar field here. We can have nearest neighbor interactions of, so basically 2 loop vertex corrections to this vertex here. You can have a next to nearest neighbor interaction, which is quite hard to compute, and you can have you can have nearest neighbor interactions here with next lines. So these are all combinations you can write down, and now I have to explain to you what these bubbles are, because it's not yet done. We have to resolve what is the structure inside of them, and this is what you get out of it. So the fermion self-energy is quite simple. It's just the gluon exchange, whereas the scalar self-energy contains all these terms, and this has been computed before, at least the divergent part, by Minard and Shurung and Ray. And also, I should say that there is the same structures appear here in the nearest neighbor interactions. Namely, in that case, it just means to cut this operator here in 2. And you see, you can identify this structure coming from, I mean, it's basically this diagram, but the propagator here is not present. And then you have the near, next to nearest neighbor interactions, which is this guy here, so which just contains gluon exchanges. That is all you can write down. And what we have to work out now is for all the fermions, the fermionic loop, the flavor permutations. And you see we are interested only in the permutation, so this part gives rise to traces and identity. So it gives you normally some factors, and then it gives you the permutation terms. And in this term, in the fermion quartic, fermion square, you see the next two leading, next two shuffling term appear, which was cancelled out, and you see further permutations here. So and these are all the structures then that you have to multiply by your integrals. So you have seen that huge number of gluon diagrams here, for example, in particular gluons. So one of the questions is, can one simplify the Feynman rules for evaluating these type of structures here? Because especially you have to remember that the gluon propagator, it contains epsilon tensors. So it's not like in four-dimensional gauge theory where you have p mu minus g mu nu p square or something like that. But you have an epsilon tensor, meaning that here, you have, for example, you get four epsilon tensors contracted, which gives kind of, I mean, very messy numerator at the end. And one way to simplify this is to think about effective Feynman rules by doing the following trick. You know that the numerator, the propagator here is perpendicular to its momentum, like it is in four dimensions as well. But in that case, what you can do, you can work out the tensor contraction, so the, or the tensor structure in terms of epsilons directly, and write down rules for the substructures. And this I've exemplary done here for these structures, which if you write them down in terms of epsilon tensors becomes quite lengthy and you have to work them out one by one. But here it becomes then very obvious what happens. This is basically the contraction of two epsilon tensors. So you see that there are two derivatives contracted in this way, and here it is contracted in this way. So basically the derivatives here in this bubble are exchanged. And the bubble here makes the two derivatives symmetric. So this diagram vanishes identical. And the same is true for this and these structures here. So you simplify your problem already a lot if you can throw away all these kind of structures here. So then these are the effective Feynman rules just to show you for the structures you see on the left-hand side. So there are a lot of derivatives coming in and squares and things like this. For example, this is a very bad thing to compute because it has derivatives sitting on these two lines which are contracted, and then the contraction is between this derivative and this derivative and this. So there are six derivatives in terms of such a box. So this is the one of the complications. So let me now comment what happens from ABJM to ABJ. So the gauge groups in the ABJM theory were had equal rank, N and N. And we go to M and N now in the ABJ theory. So that means that you have two Toft coupling constants which we construct, one with M over K and one is N over K. At two loops, it was shown by Buck, Gang, and Ray that basically the dilatation operator is the same. It's just that we replace lambda square by lambda lambda bar. Nothing else happens. So what do we have to do at four loops? We have to make a transformation rule for the corresponding corresponding Feynman diagrams, namely two loops with a common matter propagator, just the lambda square is coming from this is replaced by lambda lambda bar. Okay, thank you. Whereas if you have a gauge propagator present in one of the loops, it means that it identifies directly the gauge field, the gauge group which runs in the loop. So it means if it's a propagator of the red type, then we get the red coupling constant here, so with which is proportional to M. In case that it's of green type here, we get one that is proportional to N. So in summing this thing, we can have a look to something that happens new at in ABJ, namely the fermion wave function randomization comes in. And this, if you work it out with all vertices and everything, you see that there can be a gluon line running in the upper and the downer half of the diagram, and they have come with different gauge group ranks. So meaning that this diagram is proportional to M minus N and could in principle give rise to parity breaking effects. The integral is just this simple bubble, scalar bubble then to compute. So now this is a one loop diagram. So now we have to put it into a three loop diagram to make a logarithmic divergent four loop diagram. So doing that in this case, the only possibility is to have three vertices of the form v psi square y square. And these vertices are parity breaking as well, meaning that if you insert the correction here in terms of this in this fermion triangle, and there are three of these vertices here, then you get one contribution, which is proportional to m minus n from this factor here, n to m squared times n coming from the three loops here. And there's another contribution, which just exactly changes the sign. It is m minus n times m times n squared. So and they sum up to something like this. So you see that this thing is not, does not is depend on m minus n separately, but just on m minus n squared. So this is really a parity-conserving interaction. So can we work this out in more general for a Feynman diagram? Yes, to have also a check on our factors, and we get in front if you reflect the diagram. We want to know if we have taken into account all factors of minus 1 and I appropriately. So let's look to the transformation of a Feynman graph by reflection and by shifts from odd to even side. So here's a Feynman diagram, which comes with a certain permutation structure, let's say, with intervals here, m sides. So then what you can first do, you can reflect that graph. That means that the permutation structure is just reversed, the order of the numbers here. And in the corresponding function which you have informed, the function of which depends on the coupling, so on m and n, you have to exchange n and m. And you get a factor here, a minus sign, which depends on the parity odd parts of your Feynman roots. The same can be done by shifts. So shifting one side means shifting from odd to even, or from even to odd, meaning that the structures just get shifted by one. And it's also an exchange of m and n. And there are also exchanges of vertices which give rise to some minus signs. And then what you see is at four loops, for m smaller equal 1, so for just a single permutation, or even the identity, this is immediately symmetric under exchanges for m and n, whereas for more than two, okay, we have only two here, but in general, you would have more of two, more than two of these permutation structures here, meaning that your first symmetry under m and n, and the shift tells you that even the coefficients in for the odd and even side Hamiltonian should be the same. So what you arrive is that the symmetries of the dilatation operator are, we have no mixing piece, we have an even and odd sign Hamiltonian, and they come with the same coefficients in front. So that means that our function h should be symmetric as a function of lambda and lambda bar. There shouldn't be any parity breaking terms visible there. So now let me you might have already seen from the Feynman graph that there's quite some graphs to compute. So this takes, of course, some time, but there are also some particular hard points to resolve in three dimensions and with the epsilon tensor here present. So let me comment on that a little bit. So first, we have these numerators with epsilon tensors. What happens in that case compared to, let's say, n equal 4 superangles theory is that contracted momenta can now be far apart in the graph, in the corresponding integral or Feynman graph. So and usually you'd want to have momenta which end at the same vertex or something like that so that you can complete a square and then cancel a propagator. So this is very hard if the momenta are far apart, and which happens if you have epsilon tensors in the game. Then the next thing is that, and this also means that diagrams with gauge fields decompose into many scalar diagrams because the epsilon structure resolved in terms of scalar products just gives a huge number of terms. So and to show you how this looks like, this is just a single diagram for one of the single classes, which contains the range-free interactions of the lines here as the composite operator, but just gluon exchange. So it decomposes into these five terms here, where there are derivatives which are contracted. It's the details are not that important, but you see you get these kind of nasty six Feynman diagrams or integrals with six contracted momenta in the numerator, and they resolve into a bunch of four-loop integrals. So and then these four-loop integrals themselves resolve into a bunch of three-loop integrals. So the problem becomes cumbersome at a certain point because these kind of things you have to work out one by one. So the next thing that made us suffer is that simple cubic vertices in three dimensions are not infrared safe. What I mean by this is, let's go back to this example I had here with the wrong direction, no? Yeah. To this integral. So you see that I have chosen momentum to enter through this and this vertex. And there is a reason for this, because here I have a cubic vertex if I don't add momentum here. So you know the pole part already for this part, which is given here, but I could also accidentally try to enter momentum at this vertex and exit it at here. Then this vertex remains a free vertex, and what turns out is the pole part are different. And the reason for this is that you mix ultraviolet and infrared divergences. So this part is, in fact, this vertex is not infrared safe, because the infrared regime corresponds to that this distance of this vertex from the rest of the structure is very large. So in the integral regime, where this vertex moves in this direction, you get an additional pole from infrared effects. So, and this is very delicate, because, I mean, you don't want to mix up with infrared divergences. You want to have the ultraviolet realization. So meaning that you should be aware of where to put momentum. Here it makes a big difference in two dimensions. This exists only for two vertices, this problem. Here it makes a big difference because a free vertex in several of the integration methods which exist, you need free vertices so that they are powerful. Here you have to make a free vertex to become a four vertex because you need external momentum, which basically is adding a line, right? So this means that to resolve that type of integral can be much harder than in four dimensions, for example. Some methods just don't work the same way. And the next thing is that you have seen it here from contracting bubbles. Yes, here. That intermediate steps give you half-integer weights of propagators. This does not happen in four dimensions. You always have integers here. And there are powerful methods which rely on the fact that these propagator weights are all integer. So you have to find some different methods and other fancy things to resolve problems where half-integer propagator weights appear. So, yeah, thank you very much. So let me give the status of the calculation as the last slide. So where we are now. So we have all diagrams been calculated, and we didn't need any numerics. So meaning that at the end, with some transformations of integrals, you can do that all analytically, finally. So, and there are in total now around 162 three- and four-loop integrals which had to be computed and tabularized. And the thing is, the methods we used here are integration by parts, conformal inversion, which is exactly to get rid of this problem here, sewing and cutting rules, and Gegenbauer polynomial techniques. Then, to be consistent, I mean, three-loop integral tables, in three dimensions, integral tables are different to five. I mean, there are very few integrals calculated, so we have to set up relations between our integrals and check them carefully. There are non-trivial transformations which transform one integral into another, and this we have to check to be sure that our table is complete. Then we are consistent now with all two-loop and maximal range four results. We now try to check the cancellation of 1 over epsilon poles in the 1 over epsilon square poles in the logarithm of the randomization constant here. We have still to fix the sign of the Feynman triangle, which affects the final result. So this is something that we still have to do. And one way to do it for certain is by computing the two-loop answer for the vertex randomization of YV6 here. Then everything has to be checked and written up, which will take some time. And finally, well, I would just say what we know approximately what the structure of the answer will be. I mean, I cannot give you the final answer here because still we have to be certain about things, and there are still fluctuations because of some. So that has to be resolved, to be sure. There was a proposal of a simple rational function by Gromov and Vera here, and it turns out that it's almost certainly not correct for H of lambda square because it contains this zeta of two pieces coming at four loop. So it should be something that contains gamma functions or something else. Yeah, and then this could be seen, as I've shown, because the zeta of two appears already in very simple four-loop integrals like this one, like the last one here on that slide. Here you see as an example that zeta of two appears. So, and then also we have no evidence for any parity-breaking effects. So, in fact, the function h as a function of the two separate coupling constants should be symmetric in the coupling constant. Okay, thank you very much. That's it.
is there a way to resolve this infrared problem when you compute this this infrared non safe diagram? Is there a way
to avoid it?
Yeah. Well, is there a way to resolve? I mean, there must be a way to resolve this infrared problem, right?
Resolve, yeah. Sure. I mean, one is that you add external momentum that makes the graph more difficult to compute, but in general it works. So you have to find one way to do it. And another is that if you shift the derivative, like here, or some, let's say, non-trivial numerator momentum on such a cubic vertex, then it becomes infrared finite. So by doing partial integration here in the numerator, you can make certain rearrangements so that certain free cubic vertices become infrared safe. So this is one way.
Okay, over there.
Could you repeat your regularization procedure for the epsilon tensor? So,
yes.
So if you contract two epsilon tensors and you get deltas, the indices in these deltas, are they three or d-dimensional?
The indices are in... No, they get changed with the dimension.
So they become d-dimensional.
Yes,
then.
Exactly.
But it was my understanding, I might be wrong, but I thought that's what I learned from these two-loop papers of Semenov et al., that this is not the consistent thing to do, but rather that they stay in three dimensions.
Well, I mean, if it would be wrong, we would have inconsistencies with the results, no?
Well, back then, I think it was to reproduce, I think to reproduce these, you know, they computed Wilson loops up to two loops, and to reproduce the Witten, you know, Witten's exact result. I don't exactly remember what the argument was, why it was not consistent, but I remember that the procedure that was termed consistent was the one where you really have two classes of indices, indices which live in three dimensions and indices which live in d dimensions.
I mean, I can now at the moment, I just saw this from the level of the integrals, where you replace, in fact, such something, for example, by... you replace this here by, in the Gegenbauer polynomial techniques, you replace this by a Gegenbauer polynomial which depends on the reduced dimension. But in general,
okay.
I mean, I should think.
Sejong.
I have to think about this really exactly to get.
Yeah, I have a related comment.
Yeah.
The paper that Ian and you also showed this, the earlier paper by Semenov et al. So when they compute two loop in Chern-Simon theory, they stay in this Kronecker delta in three dimensions. That's dimension reduction.
Yes,
that's what they do.
Yeah.
And but they are not sure is that beyond two loop, whether a Slavnov-Taylor identity holds. In other words, whether gauge invariance is maintained.
Right.
So I wonder if you have checked the gauge invariance of your Feynman rules at this order, which is a very acute issue.
Not.
Okay, Kostia.
I mean, there is... So, okay, there are some... What I can say as a consistency check, for example, is if you compute a diagram with two gluons, I mean, the problem should appear there, right? Because two gluons give two epsilons, they should be contracted. So, and there are, in the scheme we get that these things are finite. And that is something that is very similar in n equal 4, for example. So basically it tells you that the cubic vertices between fermions and gluons, if they have a diagram which only contains them, it does not really contribute to randomization. And that seems to be at work here too. So this we wouldn't get if the randomization scheme would have a problem, I think. I mean, more I cannot say at the moment. This.
Okay. Hostia. You found that the Hamiltonian is parity invariant.
Yes.
Is it true only to the order you have computed, or is it a general property?
I mean, I personally say that it's saved the order we computed it. That is for certain. But by this, where are we? Slides, let's see. Here, if you see this consideration, I mean, there is no obvious way to say to get here something which really gives a sign change. If you just think about some Feynman diagrams you could write down with some odd number of fermions in a loop, for example. So I don't see an obvious thing, but maybe it happens at higher order. But I don't see, I would be careful and say, okay, say if it is a two four loops.
Okay. Okay, Rafael, give me the last question.
So, could this be done using superfields?
For sure, yes.
And would it be a simplification?
It would.
Sorry? Would this make it easier?
Yeah, for sure, yes.
So, why didn't you?
Well, there are two things to start with components, because the first one is to have really an advantage, one has to use N=2 superfields. And the second thing is that, I mean, here we don't use a priori any supersymmetric. I mean, in a supersymmetry. So it's just really, it's calculated diagram. And so that means that we don't touch problems related with maybe that supersymmetry gets broken by some scheme or something. So, I mean, there's an independent check, let's say, which I would say is really important to redo the same thing in superfields now. And it should be much easier. Yeah.
Okay.
I have one for the record question. So the constants A and B that you mentioned on your last slide, are these scheme independent? I mean, can you really check whether Gromov and Villard's proposal is right or wrong by computing them, or are they dependent on, say, the scheme, whether it's dimensional regularization, renormalization, some mass renormalization, supersymmetric scheme, blah, blah, blah?
I mean, as far as I understand it, if I fix one anomalous dimension to the proposal of the beta ansatz, then I fix H of lambda. So then, in that case, it should be the H of lambda. If their lambda is our lambda, then the coefficients should be the same.
So you can do a field theory calculation to compute A and B, yes. Unambiguously. You can do a field theory calculation to compute A and B unambiguously.
I would say so. In terms of a given lambda, a given level of lambda, which you should then... I mean, I don't see any evidence for scheme dependence in the perturbative calculation here. So.
Right, but you only compute in one scheme.
Yeah, I mean...
That's okay. Yeah. just wondering.
So since we are far behind the schedule, I'll give him the last chance to ask the question.
So, in ABJ case, there is cyborg duality. So, in ABJ, it's called parity duality. But, so this either are two loops or four loops, it doesn't look like it respects this cyborg duality. And so, it would transform lambda minus lambda bar to 1 minus lambda bar. But okay. This computation is not symmetric under this cyborg duality transformation. And so, what is your explanation for this?
I have to say I don't have a good explanation. So. I know.
Okay, if you have further questions, of course you can ask him privately. So let's thank the speaker again. And there will be an announcement from Matthias.